Welcome to the Neighborhood Project podcast. Kelly and I had the gift of visiting Wayne White in his home in LA, which is a wonderland of art and fun and creativity. And it's one of those gems of a conversation and a gift of a conversation to talk with a guy who, in his every being, is a creator and artist first. And there's so much you can learn from someone like that. We love Wayne White because he's a creative person through and through, who believed that the path of his passion, while invisible looking forward, later in life, as he looked back, created this beautiful plot, this beautiful line for his career. Many of you will know Wayne because he is featured in episode one of The Neighborhood Project. Wayne is best known as a designer on shows like Pee-wee's Playhouse, Shining Time Station, Beakman's World, Riders in the Sky. He's won 3 Emmys for his work. When he spoke at TNP a few years ago, one of his great quotes was, "The world is dying for things made out of love." This is a guy who never believed in a plan B, who defines following your heart. And I believe, and we believe, that we all have these places in our heart that are central to all of us. And it's nice when you can hear a story from a guy who's kind of lived that life and lived it to the fullest. We had a lot of fun in this interview inside Wayne's house in Los Angeles. So let's let it roll.
This is The Neighborhood Project, powered by The Nantucket Project.
Wayne, the last time you remembered we were coming.
Yes, I did remember this time. instead of coming to the door like an angry hillbilly.
A hillbilly lost in Los Angeles.
And who are you again?
Yeah.
So we're here in LA. It's Kelly and Tom, and we're sitting with Wayne White. And as I mentioned, the last time I was here, I showed up at the door and Wayne had a scowl on his face. And I thought you were playing like a game and like he's a funny guy and we're doing a little bit here. And No, he was angry at me, a little angry at the world that day.
And so lesson is, like, don't show up unannounced around here.
Well, it was announced.
No, you came just in time, Tom.
Anyway, so we're out here. So we call episode one. It was what I was mentioning before. We do a little view into Wayne's life and acceptance. And so if you've seen episode one, or if you haven't seen episode one, we made a little film about Wayne at our event 2 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Because I think you were like the most popular speaker that year. Like you killed it on stage. You had awesome visuals. Like you have such great old family footage.
Well, a lot of people said that, yeah.
Yeah. You know, you did.
That's supposed to be a joke. Well, thank you. It did go over well. I had a great time.
Was it what you expected?
I didn't think it would go over that well.
Your talk?
Yeah.
Your talk?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's kind of old material, but, you know, that's the way material is. You can do it in different places and still get away with it. So, and plus it was edited material. I'd never done that short a version of the talk. But, you know, it usually went over well, so... But I was just a little worried about it being so short, you know. Usually I take it's hit right off the bat. So.
Well, and was Nantucket what you thought it would be?
A little bit, yeah. I'd read up on the history and I'd been vaguely aware of the history most of my life, but I looked into it and yeah, it was even a little more historic, you know.
Than you thought?
Yeah, more well-preserved than I thought. I thought it'd be a little more like the Hamptons or something, you know. But it was beautiful.
And you spent some time in the Whaling Museum, right?
Went to the Whaling Museum the first day. Yeah. I love history.
That's a good place
to love history museums, and it's A+. Yeah. Really good.
So I came to know of you through Beauty is Embarrassing. Yeah. Is that pretty common?
Yes. That movie changed my life. When it came out in 2012.
And how did it even come about? Who took an interest in it, in your story?
This young guy named Neil Berkeley, who has gone on to do 2 other documentaries in the last 5 years.
Also about artists?
Yes, one about the comedy writer Dan Harmon, who here in L.A. he's currently does this series called Rick and Morty.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
he
yeah.
did, and he did Community. He's got he did a thing about him, and then his most recent this last year was Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh yeah,
that was
yeah.
good.
It's
that
called
good.
Gilbert. Yeah. Yeah, it was at the Tribeca Film Festival. Premiered
so that's
there.
Good company for you.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad at all. It's, but anyway, that this was Neil. Mine was Neil's first documentary, and I had known Neil when he was a very young man, like 8 years prior, when he was a gopher, like an unpaid intern at this ad agency I was working at. And my book came out, that was 2000. My book came out in 2008, this big coffee table book, another big milestone in my life. Neil saw it and decided he wanted to do some kind of short film, which eventually snowballed into Beauty is Embarrassing and became, you know. And he has his own ad agency, his own thing here in LA.
Did you feel comfortable with the movie, like the way that it told your story? Were you surprised by it?
I was surprised how popular it was, yeah. Uh-huh. I thought it was going to be just another, you know, maybe shown at a library every now and then or something, you know, some little thing. I was surprised at the popularity, and I was comfortable with it. It was easy to make because I never thought it was going to happen. I just was humoring him half the time.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
I really was. And he had an uphill struggle. Nobody wanted to get involved. Who's Wayne White? Why are you doing this? Who cares? You know. And so I didn't sweat it. I just kind of went along with him as a friend would. And we chatted, and he just happened to be filming. And then all of a sudden, things started clicking, and he got celebrities to interview, and people started paying more attention to it when there's a name attached, you know. And then it came out in Austin, Texas, and bang, South by Southwest.
Was he kind of raising money as he went, figuring
yeah,
it out?
He was. He did some what's that called? The raising
On the internet?
Yeah.
Oh, like GoFundMe or
What's the other one?
Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah. I just keep wanting to say kickstand. He raised that. But it helped that some really noted producers came along as executive producers when they started seeing the rough cuts and stuff. And he went through the normal hoops, Hollywood hoops, but he got the money.
Did he get anything wrong, or was it in any way incomplete, or like how would you have tweaked it maybe?
Well, he certainly flattered the hell out of me, that's for sure. You know, he made it, and that's what changed my life. Everybody thinks I'm, you know, that guy, and I am, but you know, it's more complicated than that. But he painted a very flattering portrait of me, and people respond to it so positively, you know, still after all this time. And I mean, to be super humble about it, he didn't get the can I cuss on this?
Sure.
Thing?
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't get the asshole side of me, that's for sure.
He didn't get the side of you that answered the door when Tom showed up.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, he was subtly coaching me a lot. It's like, okay, Wayne, you're coming across angry. You know, lighten up. You know, smile a little bit more. You know. Uh-huh. So, yeah, you know. He was wanting it to be a positive thing, not some cruel. Because nobody wants to see an expose of somebody they don't know. You know. You know, I was an unknown. So, I don't know.
What did your wife think of it?
There was contention.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because she totally understand it. It was a little threatening, you know, to be.
She's an artist too.
She's an artist too, and she certainly was presented well in it. But it was frustrating for her, for the spotlight to be on me
entirely.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was, and it was frustrating for me too in a weird way because it was a big surprise, and I had to sort things out for a while, but. It's all good, you know.
Yeah.
People love it. What? I'm not going to complain.
Even, did you?
Wait a minute. I got more to say now.
Did you buy the press? Was that part of it?
Oh, man.
Did you get a big fat head there for a minute?
Yeah, I did.
You
did? Of course I did.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be honest. And I dare anybody not to. You know, you can judge me now, but you live through it.
That's right.
You know? It was weird. Yeah. I had to snap out of it. You know?
Did you get snapped out of it? Like, did Mimi snap you out of it?
All kinds of things snapped me out of it.
Yeah.
You know? I had to, you know, kind of do this introspective thing that a lot of people never encounter. I mean, how many people get a movie made about them and then get to travel to 25 different cities and go to, you know, and be received like a celebrity,
yeah.
You know, and overnight, literally overnight.
Yeah.
So it was a unique and
disorienting.
Yes.
And did it mess with your art or your work ethic?
I didn't get a lot of work done that first year of the movie, that's for sure, because I literally wasn't at home in the studio. So, yeah, I mean, that was like a sort of a year not being productive in the studio. But, you know, the ego trip of it all is, you know, weird.
Yeah.
It gave me an insight into celebrity, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Say, tell us about the title. Why is it called Beauty is Embarrassing?
That's a title I came up with a long time ago, about 12 years ago, and made some paintings that said beauty is embarrassing. Just a phrase that kind of came to me. I think I was originally inspired by my father, because he's embarrassed by his own emotions, completely embarrassed and shut down, and, you know, emotional, you know, the so-called beauty of honesty and truth, you know, but just his embarrassment, you know. And it's true of a lot of men and a lot of people. They're mm-hmm. embarrassed by emotion. So my father, I guess, was the original inspiration for it. Then I started thinking about it. It had other meanings too, other levels, you know, like its beauty can be disarming, and it can it can hit us when we're unawares, you know. And it can make us literally cry or become so vulnerable and that's embarrassing. You know, beautiful people that just happen to have won the cosmic lottery and are born beautiful don't necessarily handle their physical beauty so great and become sort of embarrassing examples of humanity, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all about how there's a certain awe-inspiring thing that we kind of deny because it's embarrassing to deal with, you know. An artist, especially in our culture, are embarrassed to be artists in a way, especially if you're a man, you know, because it's like making beauty, and that seems suspect.
Kind of soft.
Yes, yeah. Especially to America,
like
to Americans.
Spaceships, yeah.
Yeah. So it has this kind of different layers and different meanings.
Are you more comfortable with that now? Were you ever uncomfortable with it?
With what?
Making beauty.
No, not at all, because my idea of an artist was all mixed up with sports when I was a kid. My father was a big jock, and sports was always paralleled art making, and I just kind of transferred the idea of competition and being a champion into art, and I was going to be, you know. So it never seemed too soft to me because I was competitive about it, you know.
Who were you competing with?
Who do you got?
Right, right.
Whatever context I was in, I was determined I was going to be, you know, the best. You know, and it always had that game-like quality to me. You know.
And is that a positive or a negative or just a thing? It's just a fact of the way you work.
It's just a fact. It can be negative because it can be, you know, it can be kind of a hollow thing just to want to win. But it's a positive thing too, because it gives you drive and ambition and desire. You know.
You know, my takeaway. I talk about you a lot. You don't know this, but I talk about you because my takeaway is and was, and I'm hoping you don't change this right now. That I was with a guy yesterday who. He had a big life change, and he's now one of the best ultra athletes on earth, which is, you do like triple Ironmans. He's a crazy athlete. And he's, you know, he was like a successful lawyer. He was a Stanford swimmer. It's a guy named Rich Roll. And he said, you know, he was so miserable. And he said the only joy he really had in his life was running. And then one day he made a decision to just let running guide his life. Just keep running and see what happens. Anyway, his life is a totally different thing now. He's happy. He's got a different career. It's incredible. And I said, you know, there's this guy, Wayne White. And my impression, and it was in the movie, you know, when I saw the movie, my takeaway was, you're just into the joy of the art. And and you're just going on a journey that you really don't know where it's going to take you. And therein you sort of find your way. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I definitely have no other ulterior motive than that it gives me pleasure. And it gives, that's, I was lucky enough to find that out when I was 3 or 4 years old. And I've known it my whole life. And it's purely selfish. And it's purely for my my enjoyment.
Even now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's why I feel very lucky, you know. How many people get to, I mean, you know, it's hard work and there's suffering. Oh, there's suffering. But no, you know, that's all that's ever been for me is art making, picture making.
And like, was there ever a moment where you thought, shit, I gotta get my profit and loss statement right? Or I gotta get some IRA going
and
oh yeah. Totally.
It did happen.
You have a family, right?
So when my kids were born, that really started to kick in. And yeah.
You have two kids?
I have two kids. Lulu, 22, and Woodrow, 25. That really kicked in for a long time. The whole time they were growing up, I was, yeah. You know, it's not always been, you know. There's, you know, I have worry, you know. Like, I had to pay the bills, you know.
Yeah.
But, okay, and during that time that you were, let's say, the most scared.
Uh-huh.
I mean, from what I saw when you were single, like, whatever.
Right.
It didn't really matter.
No.
But during that time, was the notion of the fun of the art threatened? The time when you got to pay the bills.
A little bit. I think the most I ever would contemplate straying from the pure act of art making was I thought, I'll learn this computer animation skill, and I'll get out and I'll work in some sweatshop somewhere as a computer animator, turning out crap. You know, I seriously contemplated that for about 2 weeks. You know, and asked around, and then I just woke up. I was like, oh no, it's like a nightmare. Are you kidding? You know, it's like, you ever seen Lost in America?
Yeah.
It was like, but he comes to the end of his rope, and he goes back to New York and gets his old job back. I mean, that's how lost that felt, like going down that path. I just knew it's like, I just keep drawing, you know, draw. That's my default. So I just kept drawing and didn't have to become a drone.
So were the kids after Pee-wee?
Oh yeah, the kids came along. Last season of Pee-wee was 90, and Woody was born in 92. I was already doing pretty well on TV by then, you know. And I was lucky enough to, when I did work in Hollywood, I was always the Pee-wee guy, so I got the fun jobs, you know. It was never something horrible. It was always something, you know, that I could be creative with.
How did that come together?
The Pee-wee thing.
So yeah. What was your job called on Pee-wee?
I was a production designer, but I was also a puppeteer and puppet designer. So,
and you did voices.
And I was, yeah, puppeteer and voice guy. Yeah.
So how does this happen?
Again, that was another thing that changed my life completely. In fact, that's why I'm sitting here talking to you guys. I moved to New York. I graduated 79 from Middle Tennessee State University with a degree in painting. I moved to Nashville, worked at a kids' museum, decided I was going to drop painting and be a cartoonist. I got inspired by Raw magazine, by Art Spiegelman, and I moved to New York just at the drop of a hat. I was footloose and fancy free.
And what are you, 24?
24.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to be a cartoonist and an illustrator. And I eventually, after 3 long years of short order cooking and stuff like that, I eventually started getting freelance jobs at like New York Times, Village Voice.
So in those 3 years, like, how close did you ever get to saying this is never going to come
day.
Together?
Every day. Every day. Those were my hardest struggles when I first moved from Tennessee to New York City, because that's when I was working horrible odd jobs like short order cook and working on moving vans and stuff like that.
Where'd you live?
I lived in the West Village first, oddly enough. You could afford it then. Then I moved to the East Village. Then I moved to Brooklyn, to Carroll Gardens. And then I moved back to the East Village after I met
Carol, me. Brooklyn was out there back then.
Brooklyn was like nowhere then.
Yeah.
You know, F train out to Carroll Gardens.
My sister-in-law now is raising her kids in Carroll Gardens.
Oh, I'm sure it's...
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was nice then. It was just kind of, you know... Far away. Wasn't what it is now. And so, but at the same time, through all this painting and cartooning and blah blah blah, I did these crazy puppet shows with my buddies, and they were like punk rock puppet shows because we couldn't play guitars. We picked up puppets and did these kind of crazy, kind of Andy Kaufman inspired, Mr. Bill inspired anti-puppet punk Dada
where
performance.
Yeah, I was gonna say
where do you do this?
House parties, just stupid old art student house parties, sometimes on a street spontaneously. But mostly house parties.
Uh-huh.
And I continue that. Even in New York City, I'd do them in apartments, you know. And I would crudely video them. And my friend back in Tennessee got a job at a PBS station in Nashville. She said, why don't you try out for this new show, designing the sets and puppets? And I thought, they're going to think I'm crazy, you know, because I had this weird punk rock stuff. But luckily for me, there was this young, hip guy there that's the director, and he hired me. And that was the fall of 85, and I moved back down to Nashville for 3 months and created this whole show, my first professional showbiz job called Mrs. Kabobble's Caboose, sets, puppets, everything.
Did you love it?
I loved it.
Right?
I mean, I knew this was my big chance, and I really went for it.
Yeah.
And I built this whole thing.
Like, were you all buzzy all the time?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, when you're in something and it's like,
I knew that,
you can't sleep. And
yeah. And it brought together everything, the painting, the puppeteering, the cartooning. It was just, everything was there, you know. It was just the perfect thing for me.
It's a great canvas.
Yeah.
For your imagination.
Yeah. And I took that Miss Kabobble stuff back up to New York City in the winter of 86, and that's how I got the Pee Wee job. Mm-hmm. I heard about they were going to do the Pee Wee's Playhouse on CBS.
Was there anything before
and
that?
That was that. No.
So Paul Rubens, is this his idea?
To hire me?
No, to do Pee Wee.
Oh, no. That was stuff before. There was Pee Wee's Big Adventure, the Tim Burton movie.
Oh, that came before Pee Wee's Playhouse. Okay.
That's what put him over the top and made him super famous and got him the CBS show. Yeah.
I want to go back one moment, because when you were talking about what you were doing before, is it Miss Kabobble?
Mrs. Kabobble's Caboose.
Okay.
And I think it's still playing in some markets down there in the Mid-South, in Kentucky or somewhere.
When you are doing these house parties, is there any part of in the back of your mind, like, one day someone's going to see me, and is that part of the dream or not really?
They were so, maybe, yeah, of course. Everything I did, I wanted attention for, and I thought, and then I would meet people like Mimi and my friend Mike Quinn. I did it that would support it and give and encourage it, even when I thought it was kind of dumb, you know. But I loved doing it, you know.
Did they like it?
Oh yeah.
And they'd pay attention, and
people loved them, you know, because they were drunk and it was a party. And who'd seen this spectacle that I put on? You know, we had smoke and effects and puppets.
How many hours would you work on one of these little things that you would do at a party? A
couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We'd have puppets with their heads chopped off and blood squirting. You know, they were a lot of fun, you know.
Yeah.
And
how many people put them together?
I usually would do it with one other person to help me build it and stuff. And then I'd grab yet another one to help me perform it. So it was usually three people. That was all the room you had, in these little bitty stages, too. These little cardboard stages. And it just kind of perfectly, I got, you know, perfectly aligned with the Pee-wee thing. You know?
Yeah. Just, it's also like these tiny validations along the way, like that you can get something out of your head into your hand, like that you can manifest something, and then that it could make people laugh or pay attention or ask you to do it again. Or you and another person could come together and make something better than you alone could. Like, it's all these little moments of like, see, like I'm starting to believe in this.
Yeah, it's true. And it goes back to what you're saying, that you just, that am I a guy that just follows this thing? And yeah, that puppet stuff was the pure form of that, because there was no money in it. And I would work like a dog on these things just for the thrill of doing it. So, and then that led to my biggest success of all, you know. The thing that everybody thought was kind of dumb made me the most money, you know.
Pee-wee.
Literally. Business, from a business end of things. I got into the Screen Actors Guild. I became a performer. And I've always been a performer, too. That's something that was never encouraged in my childhood, or especially in art school. But that eventually came out more and more. And it was reflected in the movie, I guess, you know. That I was ready to be on camera and project this thing. You know?
When people in those days, you know, if you ran into someone in the elevator and like, what do you do? What would you say?
During Pee-wee?
Yeah.
Well, you could drop the name Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, it was such a big hit.
Pee-wee. And you were the coolest, you know?
So everyone just kind of knew. You didn't have to say it's a puppet show with this funny guy.
It
was exploded. Pee-wee's
Playhouse was a huge hit. Most everybody knew it.
Yeah.
And there was some haters, of course. A lot of people hated him, but, you know, it was...
Not the people you like.
No, it was a hit show.
What time was it on?
It was on Saturday mornings towards the end of the cycle of cartoons. I think it was on about 9 o'clock or so.
Which is funny, because I think of it as like a pothead show.
It was an adult
show.
Yeah, that's who we made it for. Right. Totally. We made it for adults,
but it
just
was
like
airing.
Us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the whole concept of Pee-wee always was ironic and postmodernistic, and it was always a parody of a kid show. You know, and his original stage show was very adult with all kinds of adult themes and stuff.
And that was all like this big, awesome, thriving team. But typically, you don't work with the team, right?
No, I still do. I work with a team now when I do these big installations I've been doing. I've done at least 10 or 12 of them. I travel around and I do a big, giant, I call them fun houses, you know, giant puppets and sculptures and stuff. Wainorama in Chattanooga last year was a big one. I just finished one in Virginia Beach. And I work with and it's exactly like putting on a TV show.
Yeah.
You're filling this giant cavernous space with a environment like a set. You're making big puppets, and it takes a teams of people. So I've always worked with teams.
Like Wainorama, what is? I have a sense of what it is. I kind of know what it is, but how does it start? Like, who says? Do you say, "Hey, I want to build Wainorama"?
Yeah, it started with me. I had the idea because I was starting to do similar things, and I wanted to do one in my hometown. And the theme, when I go to these towns and do these big installations, I always use local history as my story, as my theme. And I liked, you know, I liked the stories of Chattanooga the best, and, you know, hometown, blah, blah, blah. So me and a couple of artist friends that still live in Chattanooga dreamed up the concept about 4 or 5 years ago. And we slowly got grant money to do it. And
What's the space?
The space was just an old, it used to be a auto glass garage. It was just a big raw garage area.
So it's its own thing. It's not a museum.
Yeah, but unfortunately it's not there anymore. It was only up for a year. It was over in September. And it was, you know, a funhouse museum, tourist. It was my idea of a tourist attraction.
Who gives grants to that?
Yeah, I know. I know. I know. That there's someone who will
local art
that.
Art foundations in Chattanooga.
And are you writing out? You're writing grants and all that.
That I didn't. Fortunately, I had partners who did that for me. The guys in Chattanooga that I.
And are you nervous
friends.
When this is going on?
They did all the grunt work. They did
but
all.
I mean, nervous that the guys are going to say yes.
No, I wanted them to say yes.
No, I know, but what if they say no? Or were you confident?
I was confident enough, you know, because the movie especially. Yeah. There you go. There's another case of the movie, Yes. Yeah. In fact, it probably wouldn't have happened without that movie.
Just like the best calling card ever.
It is.
Yeah.
It's been great for business. Yeah.
You're going to have to pass it on. You're going to have to find somebody to somebody whose life that you can touch like that.
Well, you know, I do pass it on a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's several stories that are great that's happened, especially in Chattanooga. An old childhood friend of mine showed up from out of nowhere, Randy Fairchild. And I hadn't seen him since 10th grade or so, you know. And he's a truck driver, but he's like frustrated artist.
Uh-huh.
And he's been depressed because his wife died the year before, and he's just been lost. He shows up at Wainorama. He becomes an artist again. I reconcile him with his long estranged brother. You know, I mean, it's cool. Amazing. There was a couple of other stories like that in Chattanooga. So just Chattanooga alone is, you know. I never started out to do any of this, you know. Like I said, it's all been purely selfish.
Are you part of the show?
Of what show?
Wainorama.
Well, in a way, I was.
Like, were you performing?
I did. We did some shows with banjo and stuff, and that part of the concept of it was a performance space. My partner in it, Bob Stagner, he's a drummer and a musician. In Chattanooga, and he knew all kinds of cool music acts, and we booked those, and I was
so satisfying. Was it so satisfying?
It was the greatest art museum, funhouse, clubhouse ever. You know,
oh.
And I would go down there and hang out, and we would jam with the musicians who would come through. It was just
like you made something weird and magical, like actually come together
in my hometown, which I thought would never happen in a million years. The place I ran Screaming from,
right.
Got it, yeah.
But you're sort of sentimental towards it after all this.
Oh, of course. You know, I'm a Southerner, you know. We're sentimental.
You know, I have this super soft spot for your dad, which I bet, do you hear that a lot?
I do. He comes across amazing. Both my parents are super charming in that movie. Yeah.
I mean, there's something, I bet there's a lot of people with a version of your dad. My dad's...
I get that a lot.
Never come to my thing.
Yeah.
Never been.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to go.
Right.
And it's okay. He's just not interested. And he can't hear very well. So,
yeah.
You know, he'd rather not go. And so when I watched this guy, my dad was a Marine. My dad's a jock. That's who I am. I mean, in my, you know. And when I think of my fears, I was saying this to you the other day. It's storytelling. Storytelling is goofy. It's effeminate. You know,
yeah.
There's nothing cool about storytelling. Yes. From a super masculine world.
True.
And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with my father being who my father is. Like, I have no resentment towards him. But, you know, I mentioned the first thing, which is like your spirit that I take from the film. But then the other thing is I think about where you come from.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, the idea that you're back in Chattanooga doing this. No chance are you saying, just watch, 28 years from now, I'll be back with this puppet show, right? I mean...
Yeah. No, that's what that was a thing in all the interviews last year with people, that's a thing I said over and over. It's like, this is an adolescent dream I had when I was 15.
Yeah.
But just wait, you know, I'm going to come back. Besides Wainorama, I also had a 30-year retrospective at the local museum, the Hunter Museum, which is a very nice museum.
Were those happening at the same time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a mind-blowing year in Chattanooga, you know.
And were they into it? Were the people into it?
Most people were.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it was incredible.
So who were you in high school? Like, how would... Give me three adjectives of, like, the average person in your high school. If I said, what's Wayne Light? Give me three adjectives to describe Wayne White. What would they say?
That weird stoner kid, you know?
Okay, good. So you're consistent all the way back.
Yeah, I was, you know, troubled adolescent in
you
high
didn't
school.
Try, yeah, you weren't trying to be somebody else.
Oh, no. No, I got in all kinds of trouble and... I, you know, and I was, you know, angry young man. And, you know, I left Chattanooga with a very bad attitude about it. And it was a really repressive place. I couldn't be an artist there. But, you know, I loved the landscape, you know, and I grew up there. And, you know, I had a lot of love for the place, but the culture drove me away.
Was when you were in school, did you go to Middle Tennessee State?
Yeah.
Did they have open arms?
Yeah, they did. They did. That's where my life really started to change. That's where I really became an artist. In high school, I was just kind of, you know, impressing people with quick drawings. I wasn't disciplined. But that's where I met other artists for the first time, real art teachers, you know. And, of course, my competitive thing really kicked in there. And that's where the world of the art and culture opened up for me. That's where I, you know, met weirdos. Especially, I met a bunch of cool cats from Nashville. It's right down the road from Nashville. And Nashville is a much more cosmopolitan urban place than Chattanooga. So I met all these cool cats there that were urban. And that's what they put the idea of moving to the big city in my mind. Yeah, that was a huge deal for me. And I just kind of wandered up there lackadaisically because my sister went there. You know, I just wanted to get out of town.
Yeah.
I had no mentoring, you know. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I think there's a moment in a lot of stories of artists. And, you know, I write books, and there's a moment for me where you take yourself seriously. Like, there's a moment before you take yourself seriously where you think, this is nonsense, and who do I think I am, and this isn't for me, and I'm not going to be able to do this. And then something helps you take it seriously, and maybe it's, you know, the structure of an art school and a real curriculum and
that
and
was it. I mean,
methodologies and stuff that make it seem like legit, that not was, just doodling.
That was exactly it. College. I mean, it's pretty cliche, but that's where it started to happen for me.
Yeah.
When I was 19. And yeah, so that was college meant everything to me.
What are you working on now? Like, what's still in your sights?
Well, oddly enough, I'm going back to Tennessee. Right now I have a show up in New York City at Joshua Liner Gallery through March 10th, a painting and sculpture show. And then, so I just kind of came off that, some kind of like.
Did you feel good about it?
Yeah. Hopefully it's, you know, doing well.
Yeah. Do you enjoy it when you go?
Go to see the show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you work hard. And, you know, it takes you a year to get ready for a show, usually. So that's a recent accomplishment. I'm kind of regrouping right now. My next big thing is I'm going to go back to Nashville in May and be a visiting artist in residence at this place called Hatch Show Print. Did you hear about that when you were in Nashville?
No.
It's this beautiful old printmaking business that's been there over 100 years. It's like letterpress printing, you know, with wood blocks. They've printed the history of American culture, you know, everything from vaudeville to the history of country music posters, all rock and roll, everything, you know, whatever poster event. And it's incredible old stuff, and I've been a fan of them for years. And so they invited me to come make prints with them.
Hmm.
Cool. Which I'm really looking forward to.
Hatch,
H-A-T-C-H, yeah, Hatch Show Print. And they wound up in the Country Music Hall of Fame. They used to be in an old building downtown, but now they're literally a working exhibit in the Hall of Fame. They have this big studio with a big glass wall there that people can look in. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm still formulating some big fun house installation things that are going to happen maybe next year.
Is your daughter an artist?
She is. We're all artists.
So you're 4 for 4?
Yeah.
And how does that play out? Like, is it useful that you're in you have a family of artists, or is it complicating? Or
I don't know, because I don't know the alternative. You know, it's just natural to me. This is the water we swim in, you know. Yeah. My daughter, Lulu White, she just graduated from Cooper Union in New York City. She lives in Queens now. My son, Woodrow White, is a painter. He lives in Oakland, California.
Oh, so do I.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in Oakland.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he
on.
Went to California College of the Arts.
Yeah, CCA.
Yeah, CCA. Oh, so did Mimi. She went there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he just had a one-man show in San Francisco.
Oh, I got to check this all out.
And so that's, you know, we're all just doing our thing.
What if you had a white family show? Like, what if you had a...
We've been
a
talking about that for years.
It'd be so cool.
Practice at our place.
Yes, we should, because Of course, Woodrow was at the Nantucket Project last year.
Yeah, and when Mimi was there, she did the drawings, the real-time drawings of people doing what they were doing on stage and stuff.
And we'd love to do something as a family there.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so the Neighborhood Project. You were at the Nantucket Project. The Neighborhood Project is like a miniature Nantucket Project in a home. We're going to one tonight.
Uh-huh.
And you basically talk. You know, you watch things, you do things together. We say it's like our box of wonder. We share different things with people, and then we talk about it. And we've shown your film. The film of you at TNP, at the Nantucket Project. And, you know, there's this thing of just crazy isolation in the world right now. So people are dying to have a meaningful conversation. And when they see your film, they talk about, for better or for worse, often it's sort of, do I have the guts or did I have the guts, more often than not, to follow my dream? And like, that's the thing, that's among the things that people really take out of it. When you look at other people, do you sort of wonder or compare and say, gosh, I'm lucky that I'm doing my dream?
Oh yeah, all the time.
And do you see the rest of us as sort of like,
I'm surrounded by losers. No.
There you have it, folks. We're out.
I am the king. No.
Have you heard that before? Is that not surprising to you?
Well, has somebody asked me, do I appraise people?
Yeah. Do you rank people constantly?
No, because I came from nothing, you know, a blue collar kid from the South. So I've seen both sides, you know, and I know what it takes. And I know, even though at the time I thought it was, you know, just purely my merit, I realized how freaking lucky I was and how much the odds were against me. And if I'd really known that at the time, I probably would have been crushed. So I had the benefit of naivete.
It does take delusion.
It does.
And you see it when people talk about you in these neighborhood project circles. What they're saying is like, why didn't he give up like all the rest of us?
Yeah.
Like most everybody gives up. Like, you know, they want to be a sports agent, or they want to be the president of the United States, or they want to be an astronaut, or they want to go to the Olympics, or they want to be an artist. And like 99% of the people give up. So why didn't you give up?
I don't know. I don't know. I can brag about how, you know, how I persevered, but it's all just after the fact bragging, sounds like.
But I wonder too, though, there's this great movie called Slow Mo. It's the New York Times videos. And it's a story of a guy who had this crazy medical career. And then one day he meets this old man in a hospital room. And he's not loving his life. And he meets this
skater guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that.
You've seen it. Yeah. And he says, do what you want. And one of the most valuable pieces of that whole thing, you got to know that. You got to know what you want.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, it's not that they're not doing what they think they want. I think people do. It's that they don't actually know what they want.
That's a good point. Yeah. Like I said, I was lucky enough to know what I wanted, you know.
And to not second guess it, and to not say, so what you wanted? Like, that's nuts. You can't do that. That's not a job.
No, and I didn't have any fallbacks either, you know.
Which is also a gift.
I know.
No, actually. Right? Yeah. I mean, if your dad had a family business and it was like,
I know,
either the door A is this.
And I would have probably fallen back if I had.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't. I had one thing. And, you know, and to say that I can understand it, I don't understand it, you know. And to see people being so inspired by it, again, is embarrassing.
Yeah.
See, beauty, you know, it's embarrassing that I'm doing all this because I didn't set out to do it.
Right.
But do you believe,
No, go ahead.
Well, do you believe, I want to believe, and I think I believe, that all the things we just talked about, no plan B, knowing what you want, choosing to do what you want, and throwing caution to the wind. I mean, there's that
taking
rebel
yourself
side
seriously.
Of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I believe that that's a path. It's just a scary path that you don't know what's around the corner, but it's still a path.
It is.
And it talk about embarrassing. Like, to me, the idea of like trying to write a book, like to say that out loud to somebody in your life, like, I want to write a book, is like, who the hell do you think you are?
Yes.
For you to be walking around Tennessee saying, I want to make puppets, is like, holy shit. I mean, the eye rolling must have been outstanding.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have a thing that's in the movie, Who's He Think He Is? You know, the Who's He Think He Is voice always.
Yeah.
And everybody has that big time, big time. And, geez, I don't know. I can't explain it. I really, if you put me on the spot, I can't explain it.
Well, one thing it seems like to me, it's my observation that you stayed in the work. So there's like the abstraction, which is what we're doing now, is thinking about how it is that you stay in the work.
Mm-hmm.
But there's actually like whatever hours you have in a day, like if you make a puppet that day, then you're making puppets. And that in and of itself is so... it gives you so much momentum.
True.
Versus like hanging back and saying, am I ever going to write a book? It's like you got to open your document and start writing something, and then that makes you think.
True. I was always a self-starter like that, although I've fallen into holes like everybody. But I could self-start, you know. Maybe that's one of the secrets. I don't know. Mimi's the same way as like I am. She's a super hard worker, blue-collar kid, invented herself, you know. Much like I did. I think the sports thing was maybe a benefit because I watched my father being a champion on the court, on the baseball field, the bowling alley, wherever, you know, wherever champions excel, he excelled. And when I would try to excel, I would fail. And I remember the humiliation and the anger. And I was like,
In sports.
You know, I was okay, but I wasn't good enough. And I remember. I think the sting of that, like, maybe gave me resolve too.
Well, it also took away a plan B. Like, I was a terrible athlete too. And I had two older brothers who were super good.
That was
athletes.
A naive plan B. You know, when I was in the second grade, I was going to play sports or something. But I knew that, you know. So.
But you needed a new identity. Like, that, because a lot of people in high school, like, that can be your identity. Is your sporty spice or your smarty pants spice.
I was the artist. That was my identity.
Yeah.
From first grade on. So, I had plenty of practice for that being who I was. But, you know, it is. But the elemental parts of it, I can't explain.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like, and I shudder sometimes at how lucky I was. And how many close calls that I had about giving up. I wanted to give up all the time, you know. But
it was like just in time. Like just when you're about to give up, some little signal is like, well, maybe I'll try this.
Yeah, and plus I was where the action was.
That's huge. I was in
New York City.
Yeah.
You know?
And you were always in the game.
Yeah.
Like no one one day knocked on your door and said, hey, Wayne, you want to make puppets?
I was out there hustling, and I was in the greatest city in the world where it happens. So that's a big, big part of it.
Things happen when you leave the house. That's what I'm always saying to my kids.
Yep.
Like, nobody's coming here. It's all out there.
Yeah. And the fear part, I was young. You know, I was bulletproof.
Young and stoned, I think.
Sometimes that helped.
Yeah.
And I always, plus, I took a very long view of things. I always had this, I was a bit morbid as a kid. And I always knew that, you know, you're going to be gone forever one day. And it's like, so that's like, what? So trying in this life is nothing for eternal nothingness. You know, why not? You know?
Yeah, I feel that way. I feel like, who cares?
Compared to the vastness.
You're just going to be gone.
Yeah. So, you know, why not? There's no fear. That's kind of like battleground stamina. You know, it's like, who wants to live forever?
And there you have it. That's
such a huge thing, though. That is, I have a friend who works with white collar criminals who are almost all of them are like really wealthy and really successful, and he also works with regular old blue collar felons. He runs a thing called Family Reentry, and then he works with these white collar guys, and he's like, these white collar guys are totally inept. Like, they have one way of defining the world and how to sort of navigate. And the idea that you're going to survive, that's nowhere near good enough. Like, it's nowhere near acceptable that you're going to be with your family and just get from one day to the next. Like, they just cannot fathom that. So the way they define the way to live is so narrow. So narrow. And that's sort of, you know, that was one of the things that I lived in my car when I graduated from college, and I had a room, but I rented it to someone else. It was the best. Yeah. You know, you tell that story and like, wow, you really did that. I'm like, come on, it was a ball. It was so much fun. Right. There was not a moment of, and that kind of life, and this is really my point, it ain't bad.
No.
Ramen noodles are not that bad.
No, it's an adventure. You know,
it's an adventure.
I mean, and that's maybe a little naive. After a while, it can drag you down. You know, you have to. Youth helps.
Yeah, the ignorance of youth.
And I kind of knew that. Even though I was callow, I knew that I was young, and I knew that I had the literal gold of youth to spend. Yeah. You know, so I just went for it. You know. Why not?
I got a friend who I'm running through in my head, like, how, okay, let's say you lost everything today. How would you be tomorrow? And I have a friend who I hadn't seen him in years, and I run into him at something, and I'm like, and I say, how are you doing? And he said, well, I lost all my money, and I just bought a house. So I'm losing my house. I got four kids, and I don't know where I'm getting my next dime. And then he said, and I believed him, he said, but I'm good. You know, I feel good. I got my family, and I'm going to sort of figure out where I'm going to go next. And we had like this super honest conversation. And it always really stayed with me because I really believed him. I really believed he meant it when he said, I'm good. Everything's okay. And I thought, okay, so if I go there, I can have that reaction too. I can just get up the next day, figure out the thing I'm going to do the next day.
Yeah, man. I mean, being alive is the kick.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's got to be. You. That's got to be the core of everything, too. You know, just to be grateful to be alive and know you're going to be dead forever one day. You know, and this groove on being alive. Why not? I don't know, that sounds.
It's super liberating, actually, to realize that you're going to be dead forever.
Yes.
Is insanely liberating.
It absolutely is.
Yeah, I feel that too.
Yeah, and the eternity of the universe, knowing that, you know, that's super liberating too.
Yeah, and the 8 billion people thing. It's like, who cares? There's 8 billion people. Like, nobody's looking at you.
Yeah, nobody really cares what you're going to do.
I know, and they don't care if you flop. No. Because if you realize that they're not really looking at you and everyone's pretty self-involved, then you realize that the thing you're so afraid of, nobody, it wouldn't even make a ripple.
That's what New York City made me realize.
Yeah, that squishes you down to size.
Yeah,
right?
It's like, nobody gives a shit.
Yeah, everybody's on their own journey, man. They don't have time to watch you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, plus I was a very romantic young man. Like a lot of young people, you know, I always saw myself as a character in a story. You know, this was the story, and I was going to, you know, the rags to riches, all the prototypes.
You had success fantasies, not failure. Anxiety.
Oh yeah. Definitely. And
I did too. Like every time I watch the Oscars, I'm like, I'm going to win. I'm going to win for best screenplay. I don't know when, but one of these days.
Yeah. So, and so.
How do you like living in L.A.?
I like my house that we're sitting in right now. I fortunately can work at my house, have a studio here. So I like my little
corner of
fiefdom
LA.
Here, my little corner. L.A. as a town is perplexing, as most people find it, you know. I don't have to deal with it, though. I can literally walk to the store, the art supply store, the grocery store. I mean, I'm in a nice little niche. And that's how you survive L.A. You find a little hidden garden kind of thing. Steve Martin talks about that in L.A. Story. L.A. is about hidden gardens or, you know, private areas. But I have a love-hate with the city, like most people do. It's so.
Will you live here forever?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I love this house so much.
Do you have
much,
more
though.
New York in you?
I don't think I have any more New York City in me.
Yeah.
I don't think I can take the street.
Yeah.
You know, I love going there. I still think it's one of the greatest cities ever, but no, I wouldn't live there again.
Yeah.
I like grass and a garden and stuff like that.
Yeah. And fewer ambulances.
Yeah.
If you do listen to this, watch Beauty is Embarrassing. Is it still on Netflix?
No, it's not on Netflix. It's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon. It was on Netflix, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
They rotated it off.
Got it. So, yeah. But you can get it on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, yeah.
I highly recommend it. It's, a surprising story. I mean, when I watched the film, I was like, we got to find this guy. And then I found,
I'm going. I'm going in.
But it's, you know, there's something I just, like, I'm as impressed. What's the guy's name who directed it?
Neil Berkeley.
I'm impressed with him.
Absolutely.
It's a harebrained idea for him to do that.
It's all about Neil, believe me. It's Neil's triumph, you know. I mean, he made it great.
Well, and I saw the Gilbert Gottfried. So a friend of mine was Gilbert's agent forever. And I always heard all these crazy Gilbert stories. And, you know, my wife is not the biggest Gilbert fan because he's pretty darn crude. Like, you don't want your kids watching that when they're little, right?
Right.
And then this friend of mine said, you got to see this. And I watched it, and he was right. I mean, like, you really get to know this very interesting dude.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm glad that the same guy had these
Neil
interesting...
Neil can pick him.
He has a brilliant talent for sussing out the story and character. It's really good.
What was the other one again?
It's called Harmontown.
Oh, I saw that one too.
It's about
Dan
Harmon.
Yeah. All right. Well, Wayne, thanks for the time.
Sure.
That's the Grouch of Chattanooga right there.
Okay. Well, thank you.
We'll see you soon.
All right.
Thanks.
I think we did it. This podcast and the Neighborhood Project are powered by the Nantucket Project.